Any discussion of how to meditate should begin with why meditation. There's a lot of misunderstanding on the subject of what it means to meditate. I was quite astonished on the television in Hawaii, in the apartment where I was staying a few months ago, to turn on a Christian program and hear them talking about this woman who was possessed of the devil because she had meditated. There is a great resistance to meditation, thinking that it's something that separates you from God and gets you locked into the ego. In fact, there's a lot of mistake in the understanding of the terminology. For example, the goal of meditation is self-realization. To many people, this self means the ego. And they think that the goal of meditation then is to become so locked in your ego that you just cut yourself off from grace, from faith, that you're trying to do everything yourself, that meditation is a means of only developing your own talents rather than allowing God to flow through you. A lot of theologians have made a big thing about the difference between the Christian religion and the Hindu religion and the practices of yoga and so on. They say that the Christian religion is super-conscious religion in the sense of supernatural, in the sense of being open to God's grace, whereas the way of yoga, the way of meditation, is to presume egotistically to unite the soul with God, that it's a natural way, the way that nature allows us to unfold, which is only to the extent of the ego's potential, rather than bringing God into the picture at all. They even point to the fact that Buddhism doesn't even believe in God, which is true and not true at the same time. Most of the Buddhists don't believe in God, but that's because they haven't really understood their own teaching. Just as Yogananda used to say that Jesus Christ was crucified once, but his teachings have been crucified every day since then. The understanding of the followers is not always the intention of the teacher. To touch briefly on the story of Buddha, Buddha didn't speak about God because people had been using the concept of worship as a means of achieving worldly power. The karma kand in the Vedas is a lot of rituals that people practice in order to achieve success, in order to achieve fame, in order to conquer one's enemy, worldly goals. And so he was saying, don't expect anyone to do it for you. You've got to do it yourself. But the understanding implied in that was that if you do it in the right way, it will be like your part in bringing the sunlight into the room isn't to go out there and beg the sunlight to enter it. Your part is to draw the curtains aside and open the windows. And that doesn't mean that you create the sunlight. Always what we need to do as people is to, as human beings, is to recognize that we are more than individuals. Recognize that we are a part of something much larger. An illustration that I've very often used, and it's a very helpful one in understanding also what meditation means and why we should do it, is the guitar. If you took the strings of a guitar from the guitar and stretched them as taut as they are on the guitar and plucked them, they would give very little sound. It's because of the sounding board of the guitar underneath those strings that the guitar has musical power. And those people who think of themselves as having to do everything themselves, having to fend for themselves, defend themselves, protect their rights, advance their own cause, and always think in terms of their own individuality as the sole reality, looking after number one, and not recognizing that they are a part of that one which is everywhere, then what they develop is a very thin kind of consciousness. And as a result of that thinness, they become fragile, they become brittle. And human lives suffer as a result. People who spend their lives trying to achieve outward security and outward fulfillment always find that something doesn't go right. There's always something missing. That something is, in the last analysis, God. But in the first way of understanding it, what we see is, if we look at humanity just as a broad spectrum of all the different states of consciousness that people get into, not talking of meditation, not talking of devotion, not talking of high spiritual truths, just looking at people as people, we see that there are some people who are greater than others. We see that some people, I'm speaking of a kind of greatness that is enviable. Not that envy in itself is a good quality, but something that we would all like to achieve. There are some people who are very successful in their own field, and yet we wouldn't like to be like them, because they've achieved it by perhaps ruthlessly stepping over the heads of others and so on. But real greatness, that greatness which makes for the kind of person that we all instinctively respect, a person who is wise, who is happy, who is centered in himself, who is fulfilled, who is able to relate to others without falling to pieces when they don't agree with him, who is able to accept what goes on in life without getting all upset because something hasn't gone the way he wanted it to, somebody who can handle the trials that life gives him instead of falling to pieces because he spilled coffee on his tie, somebody who can go through the ups and downs of life in a way that is loving, not without feeling. In other words, some people never get upset because they don't even know how to feel anything. But somebody who can be happy and yet be happy even in vicissitudes, such a person has to be admired by everybody, because it's something that we instinctively understand is a state of consciousness that we all want. What we see in greatness, and in one way or another, those people who achieve even the worldly acclaimed greatness of success in movies or as an author or something, they too have done something. They may have starved one aspect of their nature to achieve some success in some other. But in their field, what we find is that they are, in every case, more aware, which is why they're greater. A movie star, for example, may be an emotional wreck, but in his own field or her own field, what she can do is done not by sheer luck. Luck can put you in the position of opportunity, or good karma can put you in the position where you have the opportunity, but to be able to hold that position and to be able to rise continuously in it requires more than luck. It requires talent, and talent in all cases means awareness. And awareness means to be more aware in a broader spectrum. In other words, the point I'm coming to is that in all cases, human development in the direction that everybody in this world subconsciously or consciously is striving towards involves more awareness and awareness of our relationship to a larger reality, a relationship of an awareness of relationships. You will find that great people, great minds, great natures always look for relationships, where little natures always look for how this is different from that. It's the mark of a great person to look for principles rather than personalities. And these are things that everybody manifests who achieves these different stages of development. And always the direction is toward becoming more aware of the fact that we are a part of something much bigger than just this little ego. It always involves just gradually getting out of the ego. You will find that people who are really good at what they're doing, at least for the time that they're doing it, aren't thinking about themselves. They're thinking, if you look at somebody who wants to be a success in life because he wants to prove to everybody that he's good, is not going to succeed. The person who really succeeds is somebody who wants to do a good job and doesn't think about himself, doesn't even think about success or failure. His whole consciousness and concentration is on the thing that he's doing. In other words, getting away from the thought of self, merging that thought of self in some larger reality. Meditation is a means of helping us to achieve this long-range goal. The more we understand meditation in that way, the more we can relate it to life as a whole. and not see it only as something that we do as a means of separating ourselves from whatever other reality we are a part of. I think it's important to understand this aspect of meditation. There are two parts to it. One is, of course, to unite the soul with God. But the other is to draw the divine down into our lives so that it can influence every part of our lives, because we won't be able to even unite our souls with God unless all of our nature becomes expanded and brought into attunement with that larger reality, which is God. In other words, we meditate both to achieve union with Him and to draw on His inspiration in everything that we want to do. Meditation in this way does not mean we think of meditating on a plan of action, for example. In common use, what we've had to do, what Master had to do when he came to this country, was take the English language as it was, which, like all Western languages, is very poor in spiritual terminology. We haven't the subtle differences of meaning that have been developed by a culture where spiritual development was such a focus, and our words apply more to outward ways of thinking and behaving. So he had to take words that have other contexts, other meanings, and give them a particular one. Meditation is such a word. Meditation in usual parlance means thinking. But what we want to do is get away from thinking and become open to the inspiration from the superconsciousness, which is possible only when we rise above thought and get into deep inner silence. Meditation then means to open ourselves to the divine, to allow the divine to act upon us in our normal way of living, in facing the problems that we have to face, and ultimately to help us to so attune ourselves to that divine that we completely lose the consciousness of self and merge into the divine. I mentioned to a cardinal in Italy recently that the time has come for people to not only pray but also listen for God's answer. I thought maybe that word would ring true. And he picked up on it immediately, said, yes, ascoltare, we've got to listen. And that interchange, I realized that may be a word that people can accept and understand. Where meditation gives the idea of I'm doing something for myself, in myself, cutting myself off from the world, listening couldn't possibly give you that thought. And obviously we can't change the word from meditation to listen, because that means, well, like stopping at a railroad crossing or who knows what. But while using the word meditation, let us also emphasize in our minds this aspect of it, that it isn't so much what we do as what we allow God to do through us. We can open up the curtains, but it's so that the sunlight can come in to the room. We can open up the windows of our minds, but so that God can come in. People often ask, well, when I meditate, what do I think about? Well, that's all right for a starter, but what you really want to do is reach the point and use your thoughts in helping you to reach that point where you don't think at all. It isn't a passive state. It isn't like the state of a spiritualistic medium. That, in fact, is a very bad state to get into, because what you do in that case is open your mind up to any kind of influence. What you need to do is bring yourself onto a level where the right kind of influences will function. I've seen in groups of people, well, Master mentioned this, that in a class, if there are two negative people, they always manage to smell each other out. That was his sort of wry way of putting it. But people very quickly sort of get in tune with people who are on their particular wavelength, get together with them, and then sort of feed each other in their particular kind of thought, whether it be a delusion or a reality. The wavelength on which we function determines the kind of answer that we're going to get. And if we're merely passive, Those people who are passive, we've seen people like that come into the community where they're just sort of, they seem superficially open, but they're open in the wrong way. As somebody said, I don't want to be so open-minded that my brains fall out. They haven't any discrimination. They just let anything come, oh yeah, really, like this? And well, I noticed that at Mount Washington there were two or three disciples who were somewhat negative, and they put out little feelers toward me, and I just didn't. I always would respond in a way that would turn their negative thinking into something positive. They very quickly learned to leave me alone. They didn't like to be around that kind of thing. They wanted somebody who would agree with them and feed them more of that negativity and so on. The same thing with the spiritual path. We've got to, it's not just a matter of opening ourselves up in meditation in a passive way. It's a matter of raising our consciousness to that point where we can begin to function in a godly way. And that takes a lot of effort. Where on the one hand I'm saying that we want not to think and we want to put aside all personal striving and let God work, and all we've got to do is open up the curtains. In this case, those curtains are heavy and take a lot of effort. It's very strange. Everything on the spiritual path is sort of, it seems contradictory. You have to put out a lot of effort to reach the point where you understand that you didn't have to put out any effort. You have to spend a long time to reach the point where you realize that it didn't have to take any time at all. Why is that? It's because... It's because we've put up the wrong kind of energy and we have to block that. We've put up the thought of time, for example, that it takes time, and so we have to work within that thought until we can reach the time where we realize that God is always with us. We have to put out the effort to stop the restless upheavals in our minds and generate the right kind of flow. But once you get into that flow, here's what makes it effortless in the end. Master said, painful at first, then effortlessly liberating. We have, it's sort of a gradual transfer, like that experience that I've shared with you when I taught a lot of children in our neighborhood in Romania to ride the bicycle. And what I did was first hold the seat of the bicycle and the handlebar, and then the kids would get on and start pedaling, and I'd run along with them. And then when I saw that they were getting the balance of it, I'd let go of the handlebar but hold the seat, gradually transferring that power to them, the freedom to them. And then gradually as they themselves saw that they were doing well, I'd let go of the seat and run with them to catch them in case anything happened. And when they suddenly found that they really could do it and didn't need me, then they took off without me. And this is the way that the spiritual path is too. This is the help of the guru. This is the way meditation is, that we have to do things in the way we understand at first. But we need to do it in the way of gradually transferring that power in the right way to where it actually belongs. In this case, what we're doing is giving that power back to God. And by an odd sort of inversion there, it's also God gradually giving that power to us, transferring that power to work in His way of doing things, which is the way that works. No other way will work. Meditation certainly involves a lot of effort in the beginning. As it says in the Imitation of Christ, do violence to thyself in the beginning. And what he means is, don't be afraid to just make yourself sit there for a long time to pray and meditate. Don't be afraid to make yourself get up every morning early. And don't be afraid to deprive yourself of sleep to be able to meditate more. And in the beginning of the spiritual path, to put out a great deal of effort in order to get that momentum going is a great help. Then gradually, what happens is that you discover that you are beginning to tune yourself to the flow of God's power. And the more you feel that flow, the more you let that flow take over. In fact, what I've discovered is that and this wouldn't have been true in the beginning, but the more I think of I have to do it, the less I feel in tune. Whereas the more I feel that you're doing it with me and through me, and it's not just my effort, in fact, it's really your effort, and I'm just letting it happen, the more I feel that flow happening automatically. This, too, is why Master used to say that chanting is half the battle. Because when we chant, we lift up our hearts in devotion. When we sing to God, we're getting into that flow. But what we have to learn in all cases is to get into the way that God works, so that what we see here is a post office wall full of post office boxes. And we have to go to the right one, which has letters from Him. And that box, to find that box and open that up, is all we need to do. After that, there's the mail. To what a crummy analogy. when you go to the right door, when you go to the right channel, then you find that He's able to respond. For example, what would be a wrong channel? Wow, I want to meditate because then everybody's going to look up to me because they'll think I'm so spiritual, egotistical, spiritual pride. God doesn't respond much to that. If you make an effort, He'll give you something because you've managed to draw something, but it's just the wrong mailbox. If you think in terms of what He's giving you instead of what you're giving Him, naturally, in the end, it's what He's giving you, because He has to do it all. He's the only reality. So you might think, well, why not that? But the thing is, the way in which He lives is not to think of Himself. There isn't any thought of taking, but all of giving. And if you want to get in tune with Him, you've got to be in that state of consciousness that will make it possible for Him to operate. You've got to be working on His way of thinking, His wavelength. His wavelength is selfless. His wavelength is selfless love. His wavelength is thinking in terms of what's right, not what I want, not desire. All these things are a part of the kind of consciousness you need to bring to meditation, and that's where the difficulty basically lies. You sit down to meditate, and the first thing you think is, I want to do something. You're used to using your body and fidgeting. And so it takes a lot of effort to hold the body still. But the effort involved is really only to prevent the old things from happening, bringing them down under control so that a new thing can happen. That's the effort. To get yourself out of old ruts and into the divine flow. But remember that after that, it isn't what you have to do. It's what God, what you've opened yourself to and what you've allowed God to do through you that will make for the success of your meditation. It isn't as if, like in this world, if you want to succeed, you've got to constantly be at it. You've got to, if you want to be a successful businessman, be reading all the journals to find out the new techniques, the new products, the new what your competitors are paying for this price, what the stock market's doing in that company, whether this other company is likely to go bankrupt before it delivers your product, etc., etc., etc. It's a never-ending battle. There's never a point at which a businessman can put his feet up and say, well, now all I have to do is sit back and let the shekels roll in. They may roll for a year, and then suddenly you're behind, and you've got to really run to catch up again. In the spiritual line, we tend to think that way too, because we've been brought up that way. This is the conditioning of our minds. But the truth is that if you want to meditate successfully, you've got to bring yourself to the point where God, you can allow God to act through you. Don't think, well, now I feel peaceful and now I feel uplifted in consciousness. Now what do I do? Where do we go from here? Sort of, okay, God, let's get with it, you know? On the contrary, there is, in fact, and this is a part of the test of the spiritual path, you sit there in silence, you go into the inner wilderness, and you sit. Nothing happens. That can go on a long time. But in fact, it isn't as if nothing were happening. You're working with levels of your own consciousness that are very, very deep, that you can't really get your hands on. What you're doing in offering yourself up, constantly holding yourself up to the light, even if you don't see the light, is bit by bit more and more of you is being brought up into that light. It's like also a scale where you have all the weights on one side, and gradually you're taking the weights away from one side and transferring them to the other. When enough weights have been transferred, then the scale tips. And you can't say that nothing's happening just because the scale hasn't tipped. You can't say if you're pulling a nail out of a board that nothing's happening because it hasn't come out yet. You don't know how much nail is left in the board. All you do know is you have to keep pulling. And so meditation can also be a test of faith. And I think we'd have to say it probably is always a test of faith in some, for everybody, it's a test of faith at some time or other, or even for long times. I remember a period for a year and a half. That's a long time, especially when you're new on the path. You don't have that much other time to relate it to. When I just hated meditation. I didn't hate meditation in the way you might think. I wanted desperately to meditate. I wanted desperately to feel peace. But I also felt an almost equal desperate fear of peace. Fear of getting out of the mind. Fear of getting out of the ways of thinking and living that I was accustomed to. And it was a very difficult period to go through. I didn't see any alternative, which was what I found the most helpful attitude to have of all. When you think there's any alternative, you'll go for that, because it's always, at least it looks easier. When you find out that it too will blow up in your face, because nothing works except God, and this is the story of all our incarnations, we keep thinking this is going to work, oh, well, maybe that will work, oh, maybe this. And so people come onto the path even, and then they think, oh, wow, I could be famous if I did that, and they go and then they find it too fell apart. Nothing works except God, because he's the only reality. Everything else is just a dream. It's a delusion. And one reason we call it a delusion is simply the fact that it can't work. You look at all those people who are rich, famous, successful, whatever it might be, get to know them personally, you'll find that they're really nothing. Many of them are very ordinary people, and most of them don't have happiness, and even those who have happiness don't have much compared with real saints. Only in one field, the field of saints, is there unanimity of opinion as to what life's all about. And so, when we meditate, we have to open ourselves to that divine flow and allow it to happen. We also, however, have to recognize that it isn't going to happen overnight. Jesus said, "Blessed are the pure in heart, for they shall see God." But you aren't being pure in heart to the extent that merits the vision of God merely because you happen to feel a momentary devotion. It means gradually bringing your entire being up. And this is that long process. In the beginning of the spiritual path, people very often will have wonderful experiences. These experiences are born of two aspects. One is the psychological, the other the spiritual. And I don't know that they can be distinguished one from the other in this case. Spiritually speaking, we'd say that God gives them a special blessing in order to show them their potential, in order to show them what they can achieve if they follow this path. And so they will have wonderful visions, they will have wonderful ecstasies and experiences and so on. The other side of it is, this is the psychological, that the beginner isn't aware of what he's up against on this path. And so he goes with more confidence. He just like beginner's luck in gambling. Because a person thinks it's easy, therefore he doesn't have those subconscious doubts that prevent him from succeeding, at least up to a certain point. All his flow is positive, and with that positive flow, things happen. And similarly here, in meditation, when people are new on the path, they expect samadhi overnight. And so, even though they don't probably get samadhi, they will get experiences which later they begin to realize, wow, they're really up to, they've taken on a big thing. And then come in the doubts and the hesitations and the fatigue and the fear and all these things that they have to really work with, which they thought they could leave behind overnight, And they discovered that they were just left at the door. And now they're claiming attention once again. And so there comes the middle ground of the spiritual path, where it's a matter of hard, steady, patient work. And this is what really separates the men from the boys. Most people give up at that point. And then later on in life, realize what it was that they'd given up and grieve bitterly. As Jesus Christ described it, weeping and gnashing of teeth, because they have waited too long and it's no longer time to get back into that. Or the discouragement sets in and they aren't able to accomplish it. But if you can stick to that middle ground, if you can just realize that there's something happening even if you don't see what's happening, because it's all in that subterranean, subconscious area that you don't have any conscious control over. That bit by bit that's becoming purified. Bit by bit your karma's being worked out. Bit by bit you're bringing everything up to that point where the scales will tip, and suddenly then you'll be able to live in the constant communion with God. But if you will work at it, this is how it comes. It doesn't come. There is the romance of the spiritual path, and there is the reality of the spiritual path. The romance is the beauty of wandering from door to door with a begging bowl and holding it out, singing God's name. And it's all very lovely, but it doesn't last. People can't live forever in that kind of mood. And it's a very normal kind of attitude for the beginner on the path, where he reads the life of St. Francis, for example, and he thinks how wonderful it would be to live like that. And he does it for a while. But look at him 10 years down the road, and he's got 5 kids and bills to pay and a wholly different life. You have to look at the long range. You can't just look at how people are during the brief initial thrust. The reason I say it's twofold, because it would be very easy to explain this whole thing psychologically of what you get in the beginning of the path. The reason I say it's twofold is that this kind of special blessing that people get often comes before they themselves have even started the path. Starting the path, meditating with full confidence and so on, yes, you can understand that. But very often, while people are just sort of getting ready to come onto the path, or not quite ready, and yet it's time for them karmically, God, through their good karma of the past, calls to them by giving them experiences that take them away from their previous way of working. Or, like in the case of St. Francis, he underwent an illness. He wanted to become a great warrior. There was a war between Assisi and some other city, I forget which one, and he set out in great confidence and became ill and had a bout of illness that lasted for a long time. But it was during that illness that his whole consciousness was changed. So in that way, God's grace also works, that he will prevent you from doing that which you weren't meant to do in order to change your thinking and redirect it in a more godly way. God works in many different ways. It's not as if there was some absolute law that we can discern in everybody's life. That's what makes the path so fascinating, that in a very real sense, everybody has a unique relationship with God, that nobody else ever will have the particular kind of relationship with him that you have. And that is the beauty of the of the path also, that he wants to sing. Imagine a vast symphony orchestra with billions of different instruments, each one playing a different part. He wants to bring melody into this whole creation through each instrument to sing in a particular way, to play in a particular way. And each one of us has that opportunity, as it says in the scriptures, that he created this universe in order that he might enjoy himself through many. But alas, what he does is suffer through many and enjoy himself through few. The goal is that enjoyment. And that enjoyment will come when people finally wake up and realize that it's he who is playing this part through him, through them. When they suddenly realize that he's the one who's playing their lives, the story of their lives, the drama and all the episodes, it's he who's doing it through them. And then when they do it in tune with him and allow him to express that unique relationship, that unique reality that is us, far from, it's the strangest thing, the whole path can be understood in terms of contradictions. As St. John of the Cross said, if you want to achieve the state of owning everything, seek to own nothing. Of being everything, seek to be nothing. Of knowing everything, seek to know nothing. And this is the whole thing, that the more we can allow him to work, we think, well, I'm giving up the ego, and what we discover is that we never had anything of our own as long as we lived in the ego. Because the ego was always just a reaction to other realities. And the essence of what we are wasn't in the ego, it's in the soul. And that we can be really uniquely ourselves only when we give up the ego and enter into that special relationship with God that we are. And then each one of us will be, there are no two saints alike. Each one of us will really be himself, uniquely himself. Having given up the ego, he becomes who he really is. Self-realization then has a very high meaning in both senses. The first being that we realize that our true self is infinite. The second, and equally sweet in a sense, being that that infinity then is capable of expressing itself in a way that it will never be able to express itself through any other entity in all these trillions upon trillions of creatures, of beings in this universe. Through each one of us, it has a special thing to do, a special act and role to play. Meditation is a means of helping us to open ourselves up. In giving up the ego, remember that you're, as Jesus said, he who is not willing to give up his life for my sake is not worthy of me. And what does that mean? It means we have to be able to merge ourselves into the ocean in order to find who we really are. I remember when I was a child, in fact, my ignominy has been captured on movie film, my first, quote, dive, going to the end of the diving board, and all the grown-ups were there egging me on, and the movie camera was rolling, and I was all set to, and I, at the last moment, my courage failed, and I jumped. This is how we... I hope that's not a symbol of my spiritual path, because this is definitely how we must not be. We must reach the point where we have the courage to surrender into God's hands. There's a lovely novel. I think it's the only novel that Master ever read. It's called The Life Everlasting by Marie Corelli, the only one he ever finished, at least. And it's got good sides and bad sides. It's not a perfect novel, but it has some wonderful truths in it. One of the most beautiful being this test that this woman goes through at the end of a long spiritual struggle. Her last test that she has to overcome is to walk into fire. And many people had fallen short of being able to pass that test. And she, because of love, has the strength to walk into the fire. There are two points here. First is the courage to do so. The second is what gave her the courage was love. Without love, you can't get there. Without love, you can't really succeed in meditation. And then she goes into the fire and suddenly she discovers that instead of burning, it's very cool and refreshing. It's not a normal kind of fire. The tests that we go into in life, if we go into them for God, taking them as coming from God, look terrible. But if we actually go into them with love and with faith, suddenly we find that instead of giving us pain, they give us joy. Instead of being hard on us, they're always a blessing. Master said that the Christian martyrs themselves, if they faced their martyrdom with faith, didn't suffer at all. God gave them joy. This is the kind of attitude that we need to have firmly fixed in our meditation. I think that the first thing that we need to have, because meditation is not just practices, it's attitudes. I think we need to have this attitude of there isn't an alternative. There is not an alternative. That is the fact of it. When you get that, remember what Jesus put his disciples through a serious test when he said that you must drink my blood and eat my flesh, eat my body. Supposing Master had said that to us. I mean, just think of it in real terms, as if you're there and your teacher were to say to you, you've got to eat my flesh and drink my blood, and didn't bother to explain what he was talking about. What would you do? Well, I hope you wouldn't do, but I think that you'll understand why some might. Do what practically all his disciples did then. What does the Bible say? It says, from this time many no longer walked with him. Well, you can see them heading for the horizon like like a herd of cattle. And then, what did he do? He asked his 12 disciples, will you go too? He didn't say, oh, these people haven't understood me. He wanted them to go through this test. He wanted those to remain who really had understanding. And he said to those who were with him, will you go too? They didn't understand any more than the others understood, but they did know one thing. They knew what they had experienced from him, and they knew that that was real. And their answer was, where else would we go? And that's the attitude that we need to have in our hearts. What else is there but God? He may dish it out to us with a shovel, but there isn't another answer. And if we really understand that, then we'll be able to pass through it, and we'll suddenly find out that it was all just the way it had to be, and it was wonderful. And all the tests that we had to go through were just a part of the joy, not something to grieve over at all. What looks like a test turns out in every case, if you really take it, to be a blessing. But if you don't take it, years later you're grumbling about what a sorry thing this whole spiritual path is anyway, and far better get out there and become a rock musician or whatever. But if you really have that thought fixed in your mind, what else is there? Where else would we go? Then what you discover is that suddenly that flow begins to happen. Suddenly you begin to feel that he is taking over. And that's when meditation really begins to take effect. In a sense, we can say that we're only practicing meditation until we get into that aspect of meditation where he's able to act upon us and through us. And the whole purpose of meditation is to bring ourselves into that frame of consciousness. Love was the most important thing, wasn't it? People who have love and don't know how to meditate will somehow get there anyway, if they really have love. And people who know how to meditate but don't have love won't get anywhere. They may develop powers, but what are those? The powers only make you more egotistical. Meditation is, well, we could define it then in terms of relaxation and acceptance, not in terms of struggle and effort. The more you can relax, the more you can learn to accept God's actions upon your life, the more your meditation will be successful. Relaxation isn't only physical, it's also mental and emotional. Jesus Christ said that before you go to the temple to pray, if you have anything against your brother, straighten that out. Go try to make matters up to him. And this is a way of putting what I'm trying to say too, that we need to be able to release the hold that the world has on us if we're going to meditate well. The first process in relaxation is to give up attachments. A very good practice is every night before you go to sleep, deliberately, consciously, with willpower, with faith and love, give it all back to God. Your family, your home, everything in it. Imagine yourself in a position where none of it exists anymore, waking up in the morning and suddenly finding that everything's gone. Would you be free? It's going to happen anyway to you individually sooner or later. This is the one certainty in life, is what looks like death but isn't. And so, to prepare yourself for that final exam is really, in a sense, the purpose of living. And give it back to him. You could even help. This is a very good practice. Mentally think of those things which your mind sticks at. No, I couldn't give her up. Oh, I couldn't give that up. Oh, this point. Oh, no. And just mentally bring yourself to the point where you can say, yes, for your love, yes. Maybe for no other reason, but for your love, anything. If you can bring yourself to that point, this is a very important point to reach at, also in your efforts to meditate well. Give up attachment to what people think of you. Give up attachment to whether you're good at this or bad at this or whatever. Don't worry, your failures as well as your successes. Don't be attached to them. A good mental practice, and sometimes it's helpful even to do it outwardly, as we do at Kriya initiation, build yourself a fire, mentally or literally, and cast into the fire all your attachments. You can write on pieces of paper, if you like, things that you're attached to, and mentally feel that you're giving that up as you throw it into the fire, or visualize it mentally, and just sort of go through your heart and feel that you're taking every attachment and every desire, every disappointment, every unfulfilled desire, whatever it might be, and just throwing it into the fire and saying, God, it's yours, it's not mine. This is the whole essence of renunciation. Renunciation isn't an outward act, it's an act of the heart. That when you have no attachment in your heart, when you know that you only live for God and everything that you do you offer up to Him, then you'll be able to meditate properly. So, attachments. The first thing is, and this is when you sit to meditate, a good thing to do, to sort of just throw out of your mind all thought of identities, of attachments to things, to people, to circumstances, to plans, to expectations, to anything, future, past, present, here, distant, whatever it might be. Just in your mind, give it all back to Him. And sometimes this negative approach is self-defeating. The mind is an instrument we've got to learn to play with. Sometimes it's self-defeating. You start thinking, no, I'm not attached to that. Oh my God, I really am. And suddenly the thought of how much you're attached begins to grow in your mind till you can think of nothing else. The negative way doesn't help at all under such circumstances. Oh, I don't really mind that he was so unkind as to cheat me out of my inheritance. That wretch! And from feeling more or less peaceful, you may work yourself up into such a lather of emotions that it would have been far better not to worry about it in the first place. So we need to turn the other side, to bring the other side into play too. Not only the negative giving up, but the positive, and that's where chanting comes in. Prayer, love, meditation, turning it all to God and saying, God, it's your problem, it's your thing. And even if you can't really give it up permanently, you can bring yourself to the point where you can say, well, I give it up for this meditation. I'll put it on a shelf, and when the meditation's over, then maybe we can do something together. In other words, you're really going to the source of all power when you meditate, and that will help you to solve your problems anyway, but you won't be able to solve them if you don't go to the source because you're just thinking of the problems. So even as a temporary measure, and sometimes we've got to play with our mind in that way, that, well, I know it's a problem, I know I can't handle it easily, but at least I don't have to work with it now. And if you can give yourself a breather, Master gave us a technique for overcoming worry. He said, if you will tense your body hard, this is a good way to learn to relax. Tense the body hard, inhale, and exhale, and relax the body. Do that two or three times, then hold the breath out, and keep the mind absolutely without a thought for a brief period of time. And when the mind starts to think, try to fill it with some sort of positive thought. A mental picture of some memory, for example, that you enjoyed. Maybe a picnic you went on. Maybe a beautiful scene. Something that will give you a sense of happiness, of well-being, satisfaction, security. And then your mind will get a sort of purchase on the thing, and then it will be easier to face the worry and just get rid of it. Whereas when you're seized in it, it's very hard to get out of. So even playing with the mind and saying, all right, I know I can't handle the problem permanently, but at least for now, let me not worry about it. The same thing with other things in your life. You can't handle all your problems at once. You can't fight all your battles at once. Fight those that you're capable of winning and leave the rest on a shelf and take care of them one at a time as you can get around to them. Okay, in your meditation then, try both ways. The first is the relaxing from it all and just getting centered in the self. And the second is offering yourself up in devotion to God. And in that loving relationship, remember when there is the death, let's say, of somebody who's very dear to you, you can't, at that time of grief, you can't think about things that otherwise would be bothering you. The fact that there are some people who do things that bug you, for example, they don't mean anything to you anymore because you're so filled up with the single emotion of grief. That's a very important lesson that kind of thing we go through teaches us. If we can be so full of love for God that these other things don't mean anything anymore, it'll be a lot easier to just let go of them. So fill your heart with love. Make that relationship so meaningful that the other is very easy to relax your mind from, to let go. Be absolutely centered emotionally. The next thing is physical relaxation. To relax physically, the best method is to tense physically first. Because, in fact, that's one of the best ways of overcoming tests in life, too, that when we have a problem in our nature that we haven't overcome, many times we haven't overcome it because we haven't seen it clearly enough. And then a time of trial comes and it becomes paramount in our lives and we can see it very clearly and then release it. This tragedy is a precursor to catharsis, is a classical philosophical concept. This is what Aristotle said is the essence of why people like to go to tragic plays. The tension that builds up in the tragedy and then the release and the feeling of purification that comes with that release is of benefit to us. Well, similarly, on a physical level, if you will tense the body and then relax, you'll relax even those parts that were sort of subconsciously tensed. Inhale, tense the whole body, throw the breath out and relax, and then sit absolutely still. From that point on, try not to move your body. If you can hold your body completely still for even 5 minutes, you'll begin to notice that it starts to release its grip on you. Or, to put it where it really belongs, you start to release your grip on it. You'll find that the body will sometimes, or your thought of the body, will scream for attention. It's only habit. Remember one thing, and a very important thing it is. The ego doesn't like to meditate. The soul loves to meditate. When you don't feel like meditating, it isn't you who doesn't feel like meditating, it's the ego that doesn't. The ego is the soul identified with the body. It's your body consciousness that says, I don't want to meditate. If you can really relax deeply, you will find that 9/10 of the difficulty of meditation is gone. Try, therefore, to relax your body completely. First of all, as I said, inhaling, tensing, throwing the breath out and relaxing, holding the body still, and then meditate on your freedom from the body. Meditate on, you can meditate on space. You can meditate Master suggested that we visualize space, that we're sitting in the midst of it, and visualize millions and millions of miles to the left, to the right, in front, behind, above, beneath, that in all directions there is nothing but space. Hold that thought for a while until you really become freed from the sense that there's anything for you to move. You will find that this is the beginning of meditation. Until then, you can't meditate well. As long as you're fidgeting, you can meditate for years and not get anywhere. Another way, which is just the opposite of that, but works also, is to think of your body as infinitely heavy. So heavy, so weighty, bulky, massive, that you can't move it. Feel it pressing down through the floor. Feel yourself, just the sheer weight of your muscles and bones and so on. And then bit by bit, because you can't move it, you'll begin to sort of let go of it. You'll begin to become aware of movements of life within that body that have nothing to do with that massiveness and so on. Either one of these has the only purpose, ultimately, of getting you out of movement. Asana is a very important thing. The first thing I talked about was what Patanjali spoke of in his Eightfold Path. Not his Eightfold Path, he was outlining the Eightfold Path that everybody has to go through. The first thing is attitude. Attitude is of two kinds. The one is leaving the world, and the other is attaching yourself to a higher reality. The yama and niyama can be understood in these in this twofold way. And the next thing is asana, learning to keep the body absolutely still so that we can offer our souls up to God. Certain things that are helpful, which we've often emphasized in classes on meditation, are to face east when you meditate, or at least north. East is better. North is next good. And the reason for these directions is simply that there are currents in the earth that influence us without our being consciously aware of them. But when we put ourselves in harmony with them, that influence will take place even without our being aware. The movement from the east, for example, it's an interesting fact that civilization always seems to travel westward. The rays of enlightenment come to us from the direction of the sunrise. And if you will look at history, it moves that way. From Europe, well, we see it quite clearly in our country, don't we? To the east coast, to the west coast, now Japan, and so on. It just keeps going in that way. When you face the east, you're drawing those rays into your body. The north is more for liberation. Yogis will face north when they're leaving the body at death. Direction is not essential. The chapel at Mount Washington faces west because that was the way the building was built. And they didn't feel, oh, we can't meditate because of this. You adapt yourself to your realities. But if you can, meditate facing east better. Another thing is, Master said, to put a woolen blanket under your seat, under your feet if you sit in a chair. It's okay, he said, to sit in a chair. Certainly it's better if you can sit comfortably for a long time in one of the yogic positions, classic yogic positions, especially Siddhasana, the perfect pose, and Padmasana, the lotus pose. But a chair is all right. If it's a choice between meditating on your knees and meditating on God, I think the second one should win. And so if you wish to sit in a chair, then put your feet flat on the floor and sit away from the back of the chair. Support your body with your hands, placing them on the thighs, palms upward at the junction of the abdomen. And draw the shoulder blades a little bit together. Keep the chin parallel with the ground. Relax the body completely. Try to feel yourself more in the spine and concentrated at the point between the eyebrows. All of this can follow a period of chanting. Chanting is very, very helpful. But after the chanting, one thing that will help you to get into this more deeply is after your inhaling and exhaling and tensing the body, then inhale very slowly, counting mentally 1 to 12 or 1 to 20. Hold the same count and exhale the same count. Don't hold out, just inhale, hold, exhale. You'll find that if you do that 6 or 12 times, that then your body will be very oxygenated and much more calm, and your efforts to sit still in meditation will be much better, will be much deeper. Now, at this point, practicing a technique is very helpful. Remember that the techniques are like finger exercises on the piano. You practice the finger exercises not in order to become a master of finger exercises, but to become limber enough in your fingers so that you can play beautiful music. I've seen a lot of people who get so hooked on yoga postures that they spend their whole time just working on new postures. and finding more and more difficult poses to assume and working on all the variations of single poses, and they mistake the path for the goal. The purpose of the yoga postures is to get your body completely relaxed and in tune so that you can forget your body. Ultimately, the postures are simply a preparation for real asana, real posture, which is to be able to forget your body, keep your spine straight, and offer your whole consciousness up to Him. So, inhale very slowly, exhale, hold the breath, exhale. Do that a few times. Then concentrate at the point between the eyebrows. And then a technique that we can practice together is a technique called Hung So. The meaning of Hung So is I am He. I am the infinite. I'm not this little body. It's also the vibration of the breath itself. There's a very deep sort of metaphysical science connected with the breath. The breath is a universal phenomenon. It's not just what you are doing. It's not just what bodies do in order to get oxygen into the blood. It's the very rhythm of the universe. God brings the whole universe out into manifestation and withdraws everything back into Himself again. This is the cosmic breath. God created everything in duality, and everything fluctuates from left to right, from up to down, from positive to negative. It's that fluctuation, that vibration, that makes possible the manifestation of the universe, without which everything would merge back into the divine again. And thus you have the waves of the ocean coming up and going down. You have the ocean surf coming onto the beach and then withdrawing back into the ocean again. You have all things, summer becoming winter, becoming summer again, day becoming night, becoming day. All things fluctuate. All things move in a rhythm. All things, in a spiritual sense, breathe. And what you do when you breathe is, again, only the physical breath is only an outward physical manifestation of a deeper spiritual impulse. The physical breath is the result of the movement of energy in the spine. This movement of energy in what are known as the Ira and the Pingala nerve channels, this causes the physical breath and is intimately related to it. The physical breath is not only a manifestation of drawing oxygen in and expelling carbon dioxide to keep the body in a state of physical equilibrium. It's also a manifestation of the whole reactive process. When you feel good about something, you inhale. And when you feel bad about something, you sigh. When you feel good about something, the energy rises and you sit up straight, you look up. Everything has an upward move. When you feel badly about something or want to give it up or whatever it might be, there's a downward movement, an internalization with that downward movement. And so we have this constant fluctuation within ourselves, which is a part of the cosmic manifestation of the infinite. Every time we say, I, there is this rising of energy in the spine. And every time we give up this thought of I, let's say, I want to have a new car. Oh, it costs too much. The first, like that. With disappointment, with unfulfillment, there is a downward movement which is only reinforcing the ego. But there's a way out of that if instead of when that downward movement pulls you away from that, if instead of just going back into your disappointment and hugging your sorrow, if you say, no, I am He. This is the metaphysical aspect of Hung So, of the great mantra that has been passed down through the ages by great masters. That you are affirming not the ego, but the ego's release. A very interesting corollary here is the fact that Hung So isn't the literal way of saying, I am He. It's the mantric way of saying it. The literal way is Aham Saha. Aham, Ahankar. I, when you think of it that way, you're affirming I, the ego. But Hung, I like to compare it to a bell. You strike a bell and you get that ringing sound that seems to expand outward. The turning aham into hung is taking the ego and offering it into a larger reality instead of affirming the ego. Taking what you know and going with it outward into the spirit. The deep metaphysical purpose of this mantra is not to affirm the I, but to offer the I back into the spirit. There is this affirmation with the rising energy and the dissolving of that aspiration with the downward energy, but the dissolving in this case is linked to the dissolving of the I itself and the affirmation that the spirit is that reality alone in which I move. So what we're using is the breath, which in the case of natural man is his affirmation of life. The baby begins life with its inhalation. And with that movement, that's when the horoscope is made, that when he first takes a breath, that's when the movement of the energy in the Ida and Pingala has begun, and he's begun really to enter into this physical world, and thus to relate to its realities, and at that moment you make the horoscope, not just when the baby appears into the world. Similarly then, we are affirming that reality every time we breathe. And what we're doing with the Hong Sao technique, as in fact with all of yoga, we're taking natural reality and offering it up into the supernatural reality. We're taking the movements of the energy in the body and tracing them back to their source. One point in speaking of this is to help you to understand that when you're doing Hong Sao, there should be the thought that you're doing a cosmic phenomenon, that you're not just you breathing. I, Mary Smith, am breathing. But rather, breathing is happening, that this is a part of the movement of the clouds of gases that are spewed out from the heart of spirit, that this is a part of the movement of the ocean waves, this is a part of the seasons, this is a part of the great currents of energy and thought and power that manifests throughout the whole universe, that I am tied through the breath with the reality of all life. And you see in that thought too, you expand your consciousness from the particular outward into the infinite. You learn to listen. You learn to create the sounding board. You learn to realize that that is your greater reality and this little ego is merely its manifestation. The more you can identify yourself with that reality, then what happens is, and I'm not going to go into a whole book on meditation this morning, but I want to come back to that simple thought that I stressed in the beginning, which is that meditation has two purposes, really. The one is to unite our souls with God, and the other is to bring God down into all our activities so that His inspiration can guide us and we can do everything that we have to do as human beings in a godly way. When you have a problem, don't just fret over the problem, but put it aside and go into meditation and get into this contact with God. And then, after you've made that contact, then offer the problem up to God. Not in a passive way, but more, God, what shall we do about this? I've seen it happen surprisingly often that if I prayed for an answer, thinking He was going to do it for me, the answer didn't come. But if somebody else wanted that answer and I had to come up with it, and I said, all right, God, help me, I'm going to say this, or I'm going to do this, then suddenly the answer was there. In other words, when you work with Him, instead of just sort of passively asking Him to do it all like a petitioner, then you find that things happen in the right way. In your meditation then, when you have a problem, keep it aside. At the end of your meditation, when you're really peaceful and you feel a sense of attunement, God, what do we do about this? Instead of, God, You please do something. There's an element there over which you have absolutely no control, and let's face it, that's most of the element. It doesn't matter. He's on your side. You don't have to worry about that aspect of it. You don't have to say, God, let's do it together, but what are your plans in this? If you just give it really to Him, you will find that He does take care of it. He knows how to do it. He's been running this show a lot longer than you have. And so, with complete faith in Him, give it to him, but in the sense that we've got to do it together. He wants you to do that. To be his channel means to be an active channel, not a passive one.